As kids, we're taught not to say we hate things. Don't say you hate broccoli, say you strongly dislike it, parents advise. Your emotions regarding broccoli are very unlikely to constitute genuine hatred. But what does it mean to hate? Is hate different deep down from anger, fear, or disgust? I'm Gina Kaufman. In light of last week's shootings, Central Standard investigates the psychological underpinnings of hatred. Later in the hour, we'll bring that understanding to a discussion of hate crimes. What makes something a hate crime? And how does a hate crime differ from an act of terrorism? That's ahead on Central Standard, right after this news. Is a tough word. It's a strong emotion, an ugly emotion, but how do we define it and how do we recognize it in ourselves and in others? During the first half of today's show, we'll explore that very topic. So, hate, what is it? Here to help us define hate is Professor Toni Bisconti, speaking with us from her offices at the University of Akron, where she taught a course on the psychology of hate. Good morning, Professor Bisconti. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Gina.
What motivated you to teach a course on hate? Why is it important that we understand the psychological underpinnings of this emotion?
Yeah. About 10 years ago, well, I guess it predates that. In the late 90s, there was a really high-profile hate crime in which a young college student was murdered in Wyoming, Matthew Shepard. And when that happened, I think the world kind of turned a little bit upside down, because here was this fairly affluent college student in a kind of, you know, rural area rather than an urban area, who was basically hung like a scarecrow and left to die, presumably because he was gay. And I was a graduate student at the time, and that moment sort of, I think, redefined what I thought was important kind of pedagogically. And so when I got my first faculty position a couple of years later in 2001, I really started developing the psychology of hate, because there's a lot of classes on love, and there's a lot of classes on relationships, and there's a lot of classes on the kind of pro-social emotions, but there's not a whole lot on aggression and violence and hate and really how these sort of character-conditioned hate crimes could impact people and how it even originates. So that's kind of probably the nutshell answer.
Well, what do we know about hate?
Yeah, interestingly, not a whole lot. In your little preamble, I was thinking about what you were saying, and I was thinking about whether or not hate is even an emotion, and it is to some extent, but it's a really complex emotion. It's not a simple emotion. So, you know, if you think about sort of a baby is born with probably three or four emotions that we could detect. One is anger, one is sadness, one is happiness. Those are like basic innate emotions. A baby doesn't feel hate. We don't feel hate until we can cognitively understand what hate is.
Well, I want to make a distinction here, because even though I feel like I have some kind of abstract understanding of the difference between anger and hate, being yep. mad at someone obviously is not the same as hating that person, but can you really put your finger on what is the difference there?
Yeah, I think for me, I think the way I think about it and the way I think researchers have thought about it is that anger is a component of hate, but hate doesn't have to be a component of anger, right? And so I can feel angry because, I don't know, because my mom changed dinner plans, and we were supposed to eat at 5 and she changed it to 6, and now I have to sort of restructure my night. That can make me feel anger, but a fairly mild form of anger, and certainly I'm not going to hate her over it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Even something closer to frustration.
Sure, certainly. But when you think about hate, I think hate definitionally can be thought of as having three components, and this is based on a theorist out of Yale, Robert Sternberg, who also talks about the three components of love, and this is sort of a mirror of that. So he talks about hate in terms of what you just said, the first component being anger or fear or some sort of like passion, some sort of kind of emotion that's going to increase your fight or flight or your cortisol levels. Then a second component he talks about is like disgust, like not wanting to be around these people, them disgusting you, you feeling almost like sickened by them, if you will. So not just mad, but that extra component of you make me sick, you disgust me.
Like revulsion.
Yes, that's a perfect word for it, revulsion. And then a third component he talks about is like commitment. That hate really involves committing to a person or a cause or a group of people. Because you don't just hate sort of lightly. We use it lightly. I probably say I hate you, you know, once a week for something completely irrelevant to my partner or to my friends or, you know, whatever. But when, you know, when we really mean it, you have to be committed the way you do for love. Because to hate someone takes a lot of energy.
Yeah. That was interesting to me when you referred to hate as a mirror of love. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So if you think about love and you think about the same three components, there's a passion component. So there's sort of a physical kind of passionate increase your cortisol. I get excited or butterflies or those sorts of things. There's an intimacy component, which is like the opposite of revulsion, right? So intimacy is I really want to be around this person. I'm attracted to this person, not just physically, but I want to talk to them. I like to be in their presence. And then the third component, again, to me is commitment. So you're committing to loving this person. And that takes energy and it takes time and it takes all kinds of things. And so I find them, you know, more similar than different.
That's so interesting. How does the commitment aspect of hatred occur? I mean, does that happen consciously?
I think for some people it does, and for some people it doesn't. That's a really good question. I also don't think that all hate has to have all three, but I do think that the hate that results in the kind of violence that we see, like we saw in Kansas City, I think that takes all three. I think a commitment to hate to me is, you know, right now for some reason I'm thinking of a pastor out of Kansas who just died recently, Fred Phelps, who spent a long time being committed to what he viewed as Christian values and what many people viewed as anti-hate sort of or anti-gay sort of rhetoric. And in order to hate at that level and in order to commit those kinds of kind of violent acts or even protest types of acts, you have to do enough research and get into that kind of literature, if you will, or understand this group in order to be able to commit to a lifetime of hating them or even a year or 2 years or 3 years.
That's so confusing, though, because that component of it that would be the disgust or the revulsion is through that component piece starts to look a little bit more like an attraction, at least if not to the people or the group or the thing that's the object of the hate, at least to the subject matter.
Yeah. And that's a great point. And I think, you know, in psychology, there's always been this sort of myth, if you will, the people who hate that violently are really just sort of hating a component of themselves that is sort of similar to what that group is. Although we now know that's probably not true, but I think in some cases it is. And I think, you know, attraction is sort of a strange word, right? And so I'm attracted to TV shows that I think are really well written. The storyline is really smooth. The characters are great. I'm also sort of attracted to trash TV that I could just unplug from. And so I think attraction could be used in both a positive or negative way, that there's something that draws us to this group or this person, whether it's revulsion or whether it's some sort of love or intimacy that makes us want to sort of focus on them. And, you know, and I think that's where hate can get really dangerous because we are focusing on them.
You mentioned earlier the role of cortisol in the passion piece of hatred.
Yeah.
And could you elaborate a little bit on what hatred does to us physically?
Yeah. You know, there's, And, I'll say at the outset, I'm not a physiologist, so this will be a sort of limited lesson on that. But certainly, when we have that kind of passion where we feel like we revile someone, and we feel that intense amount of hatred, our heart rate goes up, our skin starts sweating, our cortisol levels go up. We have what's called a fight or flight response. We can't stay in that aroused state for very long. And the problem with hate, with kind of character conditioned hate, and I'll explain that in a minute, is that we do stay in that heightened arousal. And so those individuals, it's almost like there's this drive to act on that arousal because they can't stay there. You can't just live in that heightened state of fight or flight. It's not healthy physiologically, and it's certainly not healthy psychologically.
Well, that brings me to another question, which is that once a person feels something that is really true and utter hatred, is that reversible? I mean, if you work hard and put your mind to it, can you, once hating something, turn around, write your course and unhate something?
Yeah. As a psychologist, I'd like to believe absolutely. I think we could turn around and reverse most things we feel. I think it's going to take a lot of work, and it takes a lot of education, and it takes a lot of drive by the person. But I think oftentimes the hatred we feel is based on misinformation. And so, there's a former kind of white supremacist. His name is T.J. Layden, and he wrote a book on hate, a kind of an autobiography, talking about him as late adolescent, early adult, and then him now. He's probably closer to my age, maybe 35, 40, 45, somewhere in there. And he talked about how when he first got involved in the white supremacist movement, he didn't even know whether the Holocaust existed. Like, he hadn't done enough research. He knew what his teachers told him, but he got involved in sort of white power so early on that there was nothing that was really conflicting what the white power story was. And as he aged and as he had children and as his children started sort of mimicking him and he realized that's not how he wanted his children to be, he did a ton of sort of research and started working with the Simon Wiesenthal Center and really sort of talking to Holocaust survivors. And in his particular issue, he had a lot of anti-Semitism. And he said that, and he speaks now in colleges, and he said it just the education itself and meeting these people that I hated for so long without even knowing because of a, misperception, based on sort of portrayals that the white power group kind of gave to him. And so absolutely, I think hate is reversible. Sure.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Tony Bisconti, a professor of psychology at the University of Akron, about the uncomfortable and dangerous emotion, or possibly something more complex than emotion, thing we call hate. Professor Bisconti, you were just talking about a white supremacist who felt a lot of hatred to certain groups and turned that around. But it seems like once you have formed a bias, it's awfully hard for conflicting information to make it through your defenses, if you will. Like, even if that information is available to you and is being presented to you, how does a bias function in that sort of scenario?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good question. I think we all operate on what's called scripts, right? And so, I mean, there's the literal word of scripts, which, you probably do every day in your job. And then there are sort of a figurative role of scripts that, in my head, my script is I wake up in the morning, I kind of go to work, I do my classes, I have some meetings, I come home, I try to exercise, I probably don't. And then I kind of settle down for the night, watch TV, have dinner, whatever. That's my script. Weekends are a little bit different.
And in your script, you have a character.
Yeah. And that's yes, you. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the character is me. Now, also in my script, I have, other characters. So I have my friends and I have my family. And then beyond that sort of immediate role, there are characters of people I don't know well. So let's say there are whole communities that have a collective identity. So, for example, I may have a script for what I think African-American males are. because as a Caucasian female, you know, my life growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to African-American males. I grew up in a fairly white town, and just didn't have a lot of African-American friends. So I developed a script early on based on TV shows, based on what my parents told me, based on, you know, some limited exposure I had, but certainly not a lot. Now, as I build that script, and then I kind of go through life, and let's say, for example, I built a script that told me that African-American males were dangerous in some way. Now, as a person, I have two choices. I could just live in that script and be comfortable with it, and react based on it. Or I could decide to almost force myself to find information that either is going to support it or refute it. And I think that's where kind of your own kind of personal personality characteristics come into play. So someone like me who really enjoys education and really enjoys lively debate and trying to understand human conditions and, you know, by nature I'm a psychologist, I'm of course going to kind of look into this. For other people, probably, they're going to have a confirmation bias. They're only going to attend to information that confirms whatever stereotype you think. And that's a dangerous place to be, really. And I think the way you battle that is to make a conscious and difficult effort to do the opposite, to try to disconfirm your hypothesis.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the role of a particular form of hate or hatred that involves groups of people and stereotyping. So what is the relationship between hatred and bias or hatred and prejudice? Can you have one without the other?
Yeah, I think you could. I think we can all have stereotypes. Stereotypes are, you know, they're cognitions. They're inside us before we even recognize they're inside us. And so I think we all have stereotypes. Some are positive, some are negative, some are super prominent in our lives, and some aren't. And I certainly think we could have that without hatred, because hatred is an emotion or some sort of complex interface of emotions. So the stereotypes, I think, could be completely different. Prejudice is a trickier one, because prejudice is also kind of an emotion. And so I think prejudiced people can also be hateful.
In the absence of some kind of larger unifying concept, such as a stereotype? Can you just, without some sort of stance on an issue or relationship to a group, can you just on some basic level hate another person?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's hatred that could be related to just hostile aggression. So, you know, we can hate someone who we once loved who just hurt us on a personal level. That has nothing to do with group membership. It has nothing to do with stereotyping. It has simply to do with they hurt me or they hurt my family or something like that. And so I think we absolutely could feel that level of, again, that kind of commitment, that anger, fear, and even that disgust. Even though it's not at a whole group, it could be at a person. So, yeah, I think you could have either prejudice or hate independent of the other, quite honestly.
Well, I tend to assume that even the most uncomfortable, most unflattering kind of emotional states exist for some ultimate reason. Like, I don't like to be angry and I don't like to be afraid. But when I think that when I feel these things in proportion to a situation that's right in front of me, that can help me defend myself or protect myself if I really, really need to. Is there such a situation where hate could be beneficial, or is hatred just by its own definition always out of proportion or always kind of only harmful?
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. My students actually write an essay question on that. That's part of their final, is whether or not there are any benefits of hate. And I don't know that there is an academically sound research answer to that. I think research shows mostly detriments. And we don't know if that's the bias of the researcher, because none of us would want to say hate could be good. Or if that's in fact because hate is always bad. I certainly think that hate is probably not functional. I think when we are consumed with hate, whether it's for an absolutely good reason or not, I think it hurts us physiologically and psychologically. And I think we could, you know, be angry and have that same kind of empowerment that you were just talking to without having to have an actual, like, commitment to hating this person and kind of ruining them, if you will. So, you know, my answer would be, it's never useful. No, it takes up a ton of energy. It takes up a ton of time. And the reward is simply making this other person sort of be our enemy. And, you know, I think we could just as easily walk away from that relationship, walk away from that group, or feel anger if that's the appropriate emotion. But I don't think that hate is healthy.
How do you recognize hate in yourself? I mean, some of the symptoms that you described, I would like to sit here and claim, oh, I've never felt a little sweat rising to the surface of my skin in the presence of another person. And, you know, but I've really never thought of those things as having reached a level that I would have labeled as hate. But maybe that's what I was experiencing. How do you recognize the difference between being a little bit put off by someone and maybe mad at them? How do you realize when you've entered into this territory?
Yeah, that's hard. You know, some of the research on hate suggests that it's a time factor. So, you know, the passion component of hate, we very easily could flare up and then come back down, or we could flare up and be super angry at someone and, you know, we could swear and we could curse and we could even wish them harm in a sort of emotional, outrageous moment. But most of us, again, we don't like live there. And so, you know, for me, I think about it in terms of time, and I think about it in terms of that, like, commitment piece. Like, am I actually willing, if you will, to put my anger towards this group at the forefront of my mind to the point where, you know, my job is secondary. My family is secondary. If you think about, so this is how I think about it. You know, you think about a new relationship, and everyone has this experience. You have a new relationship and, you know, kind of the rest of your life sort of suffers, really. You're always texting, you're always calling, you're all, you know, you're just thinking about that person all the time. You can't live in that state. Like, you wouldn't function.
Though it would be so nice.
Really, it would be, wouldn't it? It'd be fantastic if we could be independently wealthy just from liking someone. But I think the same thing of hate, right? So people who could live there and make it sort of their life's work to devalue this whole group, or devalue this person, or make this person's life a living, chaotic kind of existence, then I think we've reached hate. And when I think about it, I think about it again in terms of, you know, so I'm angry for 2 days. I could live with that. I'm angry for 2 months and I can't get this person off my brain. That's what I think of in the morning. That's what I think of when I go to bed. That's like obsessional kind of hatred.
I see. So, and it's also, it sounds like the priority that that emotion takes within the context of the rest of your life is part of how you gauge whether you've past some sort of threshold from anger to hatred.
Yeah, I think that says it. I think that's a perfect way to say it, because I think in the same way, you know, the same question could be asked as to whether or not you love someone or are in love with someone, right? And so, you know, it's exactly what you said. The priority that they take kind of in your life and the threshold that the person you're in love with rises above is kind of how we know. There's no formula for it. There's no, okay, that's hate and I recognize it. There's just kind of the experience of it. And I think what you said is right on.
Is there a way of relating to the world that can make us less susceptible to hate?
I think so. I mean, as an educator, I certainly think that if we took time to educate ourselves on groups of people or individuals that we didn't like as much as we do that we do like. I think that would help. I think trying to understand people's story, trying to think about people in terms of not just their behavior, but what they were before their behavior or after their behavior. You know, of course, as a professor, I think education is key. And I think, you know, the problem is there's this militant extremism in haters where they only want to surround themselves with other haters. And that reinforces the hate, right? So, you know, I hate Jewish people, or I hate Black people, I hate gay people, whatever the group is, I'm going to hang out with other people who also hate those groups. For those people, I think it's really hard to infiltrate. You hope that they go to college at some point or do something in which they're not around the haters. For the run-of-the-mill person who, let's say, got fired from their job and a woman got hired, and now I'm a guy who thinks the woman got hired just because she's a woman, now I'm frustrated. For that person who could hopefully recognize their own frustration and anger, hopefully they'll educate themselves before that frustration and anger turns into hate.
When you recognize hatred in someone else, is there a way to approach that person that could possibly diffuse the danger of it? Or are you just kind of playing with fire when you even attempt such a thing?
Yeah, I think it depends on how long the hate was there and for what reason. You know, I just had an experience recently where a student of mine was talking about the gay community and marriage equality, and I'm an out lesbian on campus, and I'm very open about that and comfortable with that. And he kept saying they shouldn't be allowed to get married, or they shouldn't be allowed to adopt kids, or they, you know, he kept using this word they. And so I kind of walked to the back of the room, and I was standing in front of him, and I said his name, trying to personalize. And I said, you have to look at me and you have to say you, like you have to look at me as one of the gay people that's part of they, and you have to say you don't deserve to get married and you don't deserve to adopt. And I think when you're a person who could make that kind of personal connection for someone, I think that's incredibly impactful.
How did the student respond to that?
He was great. He was great. I mean, he basically said he couldn't. He said, I can't. And I said, well, you need to decide whether that's because you think I'm going to give you a bad grade, in which case that's not a great reason that you can't, or if it's because you're just really having trouble saying to someone's face that they're less than you. And if it's the latter, then perhaps you should think more about these beliefs that you had, probably because of, you know, maybe family or religion or whatever it is in his upbringing that brought him to this conclusion at age 20 already. And if you can't say it to someone's face, then maybe the belief isn't quite as strong as you thought it was. But I think as long as we could say they, we could sort of separate ourselves enough to feel that kind of anger and hatred. And I think we really got to make it you.
Well, I want to thank Professor Tony Bisconti from the University of Akron for answering these tough questions today about the psychology of hate. I so appreciate the time you've taken to be with us today, Tony.
Thanks, Gina. It's been a great conversation. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a short break, but Central Standard will return in a minute to shift the focus ever so slightly, going from hate itself to hate crimes. What distinguishes a hate crime from an act of terrorism? That's coming up right after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're returning to kind of an intense conversation about hate, a really unfortunate part of the human condition. Under any circumstances, hate is ugly and destructive, but what happens when it rises to the level of criminality? For the remainder of the hour, we'll be talking about hate crimes, finding out what distinguishes them from acts of terrorism. We have two UMKC professors in the studio for this discussion. Please join me first in welcoming Jessica Hodge to the studio. Jessica is an assistant professor of criminal justice. Good morning, Jessica. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Gina. Thank you.
So before we get to our second guest, let's lay some groundwork legally. From a legal standpoint, what is the definition of a hate crime?
Sure. Well, I think most people would recognize how hate crimes have always existed throughout history. They haven't been labeled as such until more recent history. For example, the kind of first hate crime statutes that were specifically labeled as hate crime statutes weren't kind of originating until the 80s and early 90s.
The 1980s and 1990s.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you.
Just checking.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the definition of a hate crime, while it can vary if you're looking at kind of a federal level or a state level, there is kind of a general definition that states how criminal offenses are hate crimes if they are motivated in whole or in part by the offender's bias against the victim's actual or perceived race, religion, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender identity, etc.
What events might have prompted this this new legislation to designate something a hate crime specifically?
Sure. I think what happened during the kind of late 70s, early 80s was it was a way for the media to kind of label acts that had been already occurring, particularly against groups within the kind of civil rights era, whether it was against African Americans, the LGBT community, due to the women's movement. They were looking for some way to name these versus just kind of civil rights violations, because they were becoming they wanted something to recognize kind of the violence that was occurring with these particular offenses.
Is the designation symbolic, or does it carry legal weight?
I think it's both. In fact, one of the arguments for having hate crime law specifically is the symbolism behind it. Not only the message that it sends to the victims of these crimes, and that, you know, we as a society support them and encourage them to, you know, fully participate, you know, in their constitutional rights, whether it be, you know, owning a home or worshiping at a place that they want to. But it also sends a message to offenders and perpetrators of these crimes, and that, you know, we as a society will take these crimes seriously, and that we will not tolerate bigotry and discrimination on these levels. But there is also legal weight behind this. And one of the arguments for having hate crime laws is, you know, for these types of crimes to be taken perhaps more seriously, especially some of the lower level, when I say lower level, like vandalism, destruction of property, crimes that might not have held as much weight normally. But if you attach the hate label or the bias label to it, all of a sudden it becomes more on the radar of law enforcement officials. And the penalty, there are various types of hate crime statutes. The most common is what is called the penalty enhancement statute. And if someone is convicted of a hate crime under this particular statute, their penalty is enhanced, meaning they're given a more severe punishment than what they would have been given if they had just been convicted of a regular assault.
What is it? I understand sort of emotionally why it's different for someone to vandalize just because maybe they're restless, they've got a can of spray paint, whatever, and vandalizing with the intent to intimidate or express sort of a threat to someone else's safety. I understand that distinction in my own mind, but from a legal code standpoint, what makes those two things different kind of conceptually?
Sure. That is where kind of the complexity comes in with trying to enforce and prosecute a hate crime, in that there has to be already an underlying crime, meaning that the offense has to have already been explicitly criminalized within the statute. So whether it was vandalism, an assault, or a murder. And so the second element then of a hate crime, and perhaps the more difficult piece of it, is trying to establish the intent or motive behind that particular offense. And you know, the reason I think for doing that is not only to send a message, as kind of what I stated before, but is recognizing not only how the effects, both psychologically and possibly physically, for the particular victim of the situation, but also to members of the victim's community, you know, who also shared that particular characteristic, whether it was, you know, members of their race, religion, you know, members of the LGBT community, whatever it might be. They, you know, research has found that these types of crimes affect those, you know, community members in ways in which non-hate or non-biased crimes do. You know, we can easily kind of distance ourselves if we hear of a drug deal gone bad or of someone being robbed. But when we hear it, that someone was targeted because of a particular identity in which we share with this individual, it heightens our sense of fear, our sense of vulnerability, and we can understand how, well, that could easily have been me.
Well, we're also joined in the studio today by Steve Dilks, a professor of English at UMKC. Professor Dilks is going to give us some linguistic perspective on the distinction between a hate crime and terrorism. Steve Dilks, your background on this goes back to Northern Ireland from the 1960s to the present. Tell us about that research.
I grew up in England during a period when there was a struggle going on in between the Unionists in the north of Ireland and the Republicans, who wanted to be aligned with Ireland, whereas the Unionists wanted to be aligned with Britain. And then the British Army was in the middle of that. And, I mean, terrorism, you know, is something I've studied since I lived in Scotland in the late 1970s and was trying to make sense of what was going on in Northern Ireland. The north of Ireland, as some people call it, the six counties, as others call it, Ulster's, as other people call it. It depends what it's called, depends on what your perspective is. And terrorism itself is named according to your perspective. If you accept the legitimacy of those who are doing acts of violence in the name of a political cause, and if you agree with the political cause, you would probably call them freedom fighters. And you'd call the act an act of revolution, as many Americans would the acts that were taken against the British during the Revolutionary War. But if you disagree with the acts, then you call it an act of terrorism as an effort to delegitimize it. So I'm very interested in sort of the ways in which language works as a way of giving legitimacy or taking away legitimacy from particular acts, particular motivations.
I'd like to maybe go to, there are a few somewhat more recent incidents that I think most people listening will remember that maybe will help us tease some of this out a little bit. Oklahoma City in the 1990s, there are some things that set this apart, the target being a government building, the sheer number of victims, the use of a bomb as opposed to a gun, and then the race and religious and nationality identity of the perpetrator. So help me understand why we call this what we call it. And in fact, what terminology did we land on?
I believe in most, I mean, I think the, you know, the most common kind of perception is that this would be considered a terroristic act. I think, you know,
They'd probably call it an act of domestic terrorism.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and we have a history of Eric Holder, the Attorney General, saying that, you know, there's an act that's a hate crime, but also that's an act of terrorism. And sometimes the line gets blurred, because if you add up a series of attacks against particular individuals because of their religion or because of their sexuality or because of their national affiliation, eventually it adds up to a terrorist campaign. And so in a sense, the distinction is that a terrorism is an orchestrated series of attacks against a particular entity, in this case, the American government, apparently. And so because Timothy McVeigh, whose name, unfortunately, we remember more than we remember the victims, and that's something I'm always struck by, is that, you know, when I was doing research for today, it's much easier to find the name of the person who shot people at the Jewish Center than it is to find the names of those who were killed. So people, you know, we need to remember the name of Terry Lamano and William Corcoran and Reet Underwood as the people whose names need to be remembered.
What is, linguistically speaking, what does remembering a name say about our values or our perception of an incident?
Well, exactly. It gives legitimacy. It underscores the importance of those whose names we remember. And if we remember the names of the people who did it, and if we keep repeating those names, we are in some way giving the kind of legitimacy that they were asking for, that the attention that they were demanding when they perpetrated that act.
Jessica, I wonder if what Professor Dilks has just said rings true for you, this idea that a single incident can be a hate crime, but a single incident that is isolated maybe couldn't be terrorism, that terrorism is an orchestrated series of events.
Yes, it's interesting when we start trying to name events like this, whether it was an act of terror or a hate crime incident, in the sense where oftentimes the underlying objective of these crimes is to really the desire to intimidate, you know, our larger group of people or a government entity. And so we see some of that here where, you know, also to kind of some of the similarities between the two, you know, whether we're looking at hate crimes or acts of terror, that, you know, a mission oftentimes is to seek the world or seek to rid the world of what they perceive to be some evil, or to protect or defend what they perceive to be something that they are entitled to, whether it is their, you know, their neighborhood or their country. And so there are a lot of similarities. However, the distinction comes in, and that I think Steve mentioned, how, you know, what we consider to be acts of terror, or generally what are defined as such, are very kind of planned attacks. They're part of a larger sustained effort to draw attention to some cause. And that is not always the case. It can be the case in events in which we call hate crime, but not always. And in fact, some of the distinction comes in when we look at what might be a hate crime. Actually, the typical offender is oftentimes a younger offender, late teens, early 20s.
Why is that?
You know, it's a good question. You know, and in fact, you know, it's oftentimes, you know, it's very similar to what our average criminal offender is in general, you know, in bias and non-bias crimes. So it's called what we criminologists like to call the age crime curve, where it peaks in the late teens and early 20s. And there's a variety of explanations to try and capture why that happens. But then people's criminality tends to decrease as they get older and more, whether it's maturity, learn to use other means to resolve conflicts versus violence, or, you know, a destruction of property. They become more entrenched in kind of the normal kind of social values versus the criminal values. And so there's a lot of different explanations on why that it kind of peaks there. But with, you know, hate crime offenders, we have found when we look at the numbers, that tends to be our, quote, typical offender. And oftentimes, too, similar to other kind of regular crimes or non-biased crimes, drugs and alcohol are involved as well. And facilitates the act. And so one of the distinctions is where a domestic terrorist act, for instance, is often planned and maybe associated with a formal organization. That's not the case with your typical hate crime offender. It's, in fact, there's very little formal planning, and there's little foresight or calculation involved.
Interesting. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking this morning with Jessica Hodge from UMKC's Criminal Justice Department and Steve Dilks of the English Department, here to discuss hate crimes and terrorism and kind of the murky, what sounds like a very murky distinction between the two.
Well, what I'd say is actually the murkiness is okay. the problems arise when people think that they have to define themselves very, very neatly according to a very strict understanding of what it means to be Christian or what it means to be Jewish or what it means to be, you know, of a particular ethnicity or a particular national origin. You know, if to, you know, I'm English, thus I act like this. And people actually get into trouble when they have such a strict understanding of their identity that they want to go out into the world and impose that on other people. And they see somebody who is Jewish, see somebody who is black, and they assign a whole set of characteristics to them that don't take into account. I think the previous show that you had on, the guy was talking about how important it is to individualize, how important it is to create a social interaction between two people of different backgrounds, and that means that you can no longer be quite so simplistic and reductive in the way in which you identify the other.
It seems like there is some importance that we who are just out in society observing and responding to and trying to process these scenarios, it becomes important to us whether something is called just a crime, a tragedy, or whether we call that a hate crime, whether we call it terrorism. And it's sometimes especially important to the communities of the victims, whether things are labeled in these ways. What would be the significance of calling something terrorism versus a hate crime to the societies at large?
Well, if you call it terrorism, you can mobilize an entire force against it. And that would include the CIA, the FBI, the US Army, an act of terrorism is an act against the West, or it's an act against all Americans, or it's an act against the British. So when the IRA decide to do a terrorist bombing campaign on the mainland of Britain, they were calling attention to themselves, and they were attacking anybody who went to the pub in Britain during the 1970s had to be at least afraid that they might possibly be the victim of a bomb going off. Now, of course, what the British wanted to do with that was delegitimate that particular cause, and so they decided that they would call them criminals and they didn't want them to be called soldiers. They didn't want it to be that it was a legitimate political cause. And so they named it a very specific thing, which was that they were criminals. So Margaret Thatcher is famous for saying a criminal is a criminal is a criminal when referring to Bobby Sands. And obviously Bobby Sands and the people he was in an organization with want to say, no, we're prisoners of war, we are fighting a particular struggle. And so the definitions were very, very crucial to that struggle. And to be honest, Bobby Sands and his colleagues won that particular struggle over language.
Well, first of all, can you remind us who Bobby Sands was?
Bobby Sands was a Catholic from Belfast who was a Republican who was put in prison in Longkesh in the 1970s for an act of an act of terrorism. But once he was in there, the British changed the rules about how they defined terrorists who had been put in prison. And so they started to refer to them as criminals, and they took away their prisoner of war status. And so Bobby Sands protested with another group of people in Longkesh, the prison just outside Belfast. And they, first of all, protested by refusing to wear prison clothes, and then they refused to slop out their cells, and so they went on the dirty protest where they covered the walls of their cells with excrement, and then eventually they went on hunger strike, and Bobby Sands, on May the 5th, 1981, died after 66 days on a hunger strike. And in many ways, his act of what you might now recognize as civil disobedience, in the same sort of vein as Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, managed to change the whole discourse of Northern Ireland.
This is interesting to me because it sounds like, although part of the definition of a hate crime, or I would think of terrorism, involves a bias against another group, it also seems like in our decisions about how to label things, we betray certain other biases at times.
Yeah. I mean, I can't talk about the situation in the north of Ireland without... If I refer to it as the north of Ireland, I am showing that I think of it as a place that is north of the Republic of Ireland. If I call it Northern Ireland, I'm already legitimating the idea that it is a separate nation that is connected with the United Kingdom. And if I call it Ulster, I am, you know, indicating other things if I call it the six counties. So what we call things really does, all revolutions are about language is something that I would probably say on a regular basis to my class. And
And just to add to that, with hate crimes within our laws, we have distinct categories of groups of people who are considered to be protected under these statutes, and these categories differ from the federal statutes to the state levels as well. And that's why I say when the general definition of a hate crime, there is a kind of a general definition, but the particular groups within those definitions can vary, and they tend to be more the kind of traditional stigmatized groups within society, those that have been discriminated against at extreme levels. For instance, what we consider the kind of core categories of hate crime legislation are race, religion, and national origin, whereas some of the other groups that have been later included within both federal and state statutes include groups such as sexual orientation, gender, disability, and more recently we're seeing an inclusion of gender identity. And so you're absolutely right. You know, but I think one point too that people often make against hate crime laws is that they're saying, well, we're only protecting a certain race or we're only protecting a certain religion. And that's not true. I mean, there have been victims who are part of the majority, whether that be with Christians or crimes against whites or whatever, or someone who is victimized because they are straight. And so it can go both ways.
Something that kind of interests me with this, the current issue in Johnson County with the recent shootings, if that ends up being filed as hate crimes, it's already charges of murder have been filed, but hate crimes, it's still up in the air. What would be the ramifications of that? Would that make it harder or easier to prosecute, or would it not affect the criminal justice approach?
It's interesting in the sense when we're talking about a murder, I mean, the penalty associated with a homicide is already severe. And so attaching the hate label is more about, I think, sending a message versus what the sentence might be. It's more of the lower level offenses in which this naming or the label becomes more important, and to recognize the seriousness of it versus it's just, well, someone threw a rock through a window.
That's all the time we have today for this conversation, but I want to thank Jessica Hodge and Steve Dilks for being here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Listen back to today's show or visit previous conversations, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Tune in tomorrow to hear about the life and death of the indoor shopping mall. As the hot new places of the 1980s and 90s are repurposed or torn down, where are we building our consumer dreams? Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Our announcer is Linda Scher. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's all for today's Central Standard. I don't know about you, but I could sure use a Wonder Woman to save me from the material we just explored. Stay tuned for Super Heroines on Up to Date next.